And our final case for this morning is United States against Robinson.
Good morning. I'm George Tassif with the Federal Public Defender in Peoria, appearing for Abraham Robinson. Two issues raised on appeal, both of which stem from the same body of evidence presented before the court on a motion to suppress. For the court's convenience and consideration, appended at page 14 of our brief is Defense Exhibit 1, which is an overhead surveillance photograph of the neighborhood in which this incident occurred. And I direct the court's attention to this because from the briefs, it may be difficult to assess the environment in which the officers were conducting surveillance and where the parties were appearing. But what you have on the west end of Rock Island are two avenues, 7th Avenue and 9th Avenue, which are joined by a series of streets. And the particular street here at issue is this short side street, 7th Street, that joins both 7th Avenue and 9th Avenue. At the top of 7th Street and 7th Avenue, just to the left, that structure is Jimmy's Tavern, where all of this is occurring. Across the street to the right of the tavern is, and there's a slight circle you'll see from the exhibit in the appendix, that's where Mr. Robinson was accosted by the 5 to 6 officers who approached behind him. And then to the bottom of 7th Street, 7th and 9th Avenue, to the right-hand corner, that's Jeffy Lee's house, where the phone call came and where individuals were observed by the police to be congregating. So with that in mind, we read the judge's district court's order denying the motion to suppress, and two-thirds of that order, which is appended in our brief, would indicate that the court accepted our argument that under JL, the officers did not have reasonable suspicion based upon the anonymous tips that they were apprised of during this half hour of surveillance outside the tavern to conduct a Terry stop.
But it seems to me these officers knew considerably more than was known about the anonymous tipper in JL. First of all, the source makes the report in person, gives more details, is corroborated by the 911 call. I mean, there is more going on. It's not just a naked, you know, I saw a person wearing a red tie, you know, and he must be a bad guy.
I respectfully disagree because the first CS approaches Officer Sowards outside the tavern and says that Big Salt or Salty Dog has a gun, points him out. How does he know this? He met with an unidentified female inside the tavern sometime during the course of that evening, the exact time of which is unknown.
Do you think the Supreme Court was drawing a line? If you tell an officer something like that face-to-face, you're putting your reputation on the line in a way that you don't if it's just a phone call.
Well, all this confidential source is doing here, in this instance, as the district court acknowledged, was relaying to the police what some unidentified third person had said to him or her.
No, there's more to it than that. The confidential source comes back later and says to the cops, by the way, Salty Dog was kicked out of the bar by the employees because he had a gun, or denied admittance to the bar because he had a gun. So that's information apart from what the confidential source had from the anonymous tipster.
Because he was barred because of an incident that
because
had occurred
he had a
week
gun.
Or so earlier. And, again, this unidentified female, whoever she may be, or whatever time she spoke to Salty Dog, reports he has a gun. So, in essence, the police are relying upon this third party.
So they go and they surveil Jeffy's house.
Surveil Jeffy's
house.
And
what they see is the defendant with something heavy in his pocket, protecting the pocket for a period of some, 15 minutes?
Multiple subjects congregating outside Jeffy Lee's house.
Well, right, but the officers plainly testified that he was behaving as though he had something heavy in his pocket, which they suspected was a gun, reasonably given the information that they had, and that he was protecting that pocket and padding it and so on.
Well, he was proceeding northbound on the sidewalk when they observed him what appeared to be favoring his right side. But it's also important to note that he was wearing a large pullover-type red shirt and loose-fitting baggy pants. So when the police appear behind him, five strong, at least five officers, having been given the word by their supervisor, Sergeant Hawker, to take him down now, the district court, in its order, and we submit, said and ruled that the police effectively seized him when they ordered him to stop, police, and raise his hands. The district court, in making its findings, said the best characterization of the officer's testimony from that point on was that Mr. Robinson turned to his left and his hands moved towards his waistband or pocket. And at that time, the district court ruled. It was prepared to rule under JL that if the hands had come up, it would be an illegal search. But because the hands momentarily went towards the waistband, in the district court's words, it changed the whole equation and transformed the encounter from a JL type of situation to grounds for a forcible Terry stop and frisk. We respectfully submit that that factor, and solely that factor which the court is relying upon in this instance and under these unique circumstances, is not sufficient to transform a stop that is not based upon the requisite reasonable suspicion that Mr. Robinson...
But we're not bound by the district court's analysis in that regard. This is de novo review of the question of when and whether there was a seizure and when and whether there was reasonable suspicion for that.
But with respect to findings of fact, there's a clear error standard of review,
right,
which
but
is
what,
deferential
but the question,
to what the court did.
Right, but we don't really have a factual dispute here about the evidentiary facts. What we have is a dispute about their legal consequence under the Fourth Amendment, and at what point was there a seizure, and what type of a seizure was it, and was there reasonable suspicion for it. And what the police have at the time that they approach is word from two filtered anonymous sources that Salty Dog has a gun. They know who Salty Dog is. They know his criminal history. They know he's dangerous, he's violent, he's a drug dealer. They also have information that employees at the tavern said that he was ejected from the tavern or denied admittance because he was armed and that there had been an incident earlier that he was likely seeking revenge for. So they've got that as well. Then they've got their 15 or 20 minutes of surveillance of him where he's walking around like he's got something heavy in his pockets, and the cops know how to, you know, figure out what's going on with that. And he's favoring his right side, and he's patting his right side. He's pulling up his pants like he's got something heavy in his pocket, reasonably signifying a gun under these circumstances with everything else that they know. Why isn't all of that enough to justify a Terry stop and frisk?
Well,
putting aside the, you know, what he does after they say stop, police, raise your hands.
The district court, having heard the same evidence.
It doesn't matter what the district court concluded about that. It's de novo review, so don't talk about that.
Secondly, though, I would respond to this one thing. The second CS, the second tip, Jeffy Lee did not report that Salty Dog had a gun. Jeffy Lee reported that someone had told her that someone outside her house was in possession of a gun. So again, I don't think there's that much weight to the second report that Your Honor, through your question, is establishing for Jeffy Lee's
totality of the circumstances.
The totality, I would respectfully submit, is nothing more than the anonymous tip that would warrant further surveillance, but not justify.
There's more than an anonymous tip, though. There's much more. All of the other factors I just cited.
Other factors too, which the courts have said.
You need to stay in front of the microphone there, so we get all here.
Other factors which courts have said, high crime neighborhood, criminal history, other factors that indeed can be considered by the district court. But
the observations of the police at the scene, the information from the employees at the tavern, even though it's once removed, hearsay's okay.
And Your Honor is for the most part, reciting precisely the facts of the record. And our position was that there was no reasonable suspicion under JL. The seizure occurred without that, and cannot be justified by after-acquired information. The two sentencing questions basically piggyback what happened at the motion to suppress. The government comes in with two adjustments that they protest the probation officer didn't apply, that Mr. Robinson should receive an additional 10 levels because under both adjustments, 2K and 3C, his attempts at retrieving the gun to use against the police or to do them bodily harm or to engage in the offenses of attempted aggravated battery or attempted aggravated discharge warranted an additional 10 levels. And as authority, they cite the case of United States versus Weaver from this court. Weaver dealt with a situation where the defendant was repeatedly reaching across his body to a pocket of a jacket from which the handle of the gun protruded. Weaver involved a situation where Mr. Weaver assaulted the officers, kicked one of them in the chest. Weaver involved the defendant saying to the police, "Kill me, I don't want to go back to prison," thus evidencing his desperation. And Weaver involved the district court's finding of fact that the defendant reached for the gun to use against the officers. What I respectfully submit Judge Mim did was find physical resistance by Mr. Robinson, but never went on to say or to find, at least explicitly, that his intent to retrieve the gun was to discharge it or to do bodily harm to the police. That finding is never made at all. And these are 10 additional levels that were basically 2.5 times as projected guideline range is what this came in at. Of course, Judge Mim would say, I'm not going to assess that kind of range.
Okay, Mr. Tassif, your time has run out. I will give you 1 minute after the government has argued.
Thank you.
Mr. Hansen.
Thank you, Your Honor. And it's clear from the discussion that the court has a clear view of the facts here. But let me add just a few more if I can. It's 2:30 in the morning. There are 6 uniformed police officers outside this area for the specific reason of crowd control, because this is a troublesome area.
Mr. Hansen, I wonder if I could get you to jump ahead to one of the sentencing adjustments. The one that concerns me is not so much 3A1.1, but it's 2K2.1, because that's the one that requires some kind of intent, as I read it, that he actually was going to try to shoot the officers. The aggravated, the other felony that the government was relying on was either aggravated battery with a firearm or aggravated discharge of a firearm. Both of those require proof of knowingly or intentionally discharging a firearm, so the attempt offense would be attempting knowingly or intentionally to discharge a firearm. And even though I can see the argument in the earlier one, the 3A1.1, for finding serious risk of, substantial risk of serious bodily injury to the officers, I don't see what the evidence is that that very same act of his hand moving down is enough to allow us to infer specific intent to discharge the firearm. Seems to me he could have been hoping to just grab it and hit them over the head with it, or he could have been hoping to throw it off into the grass, or he could have been hoping to do many things with it, any of which would have created a risk under the 6-level enhancement, but which would not necessarily meet the criteria for 2K2.1.
I'm going to respectfully disagree with only the assertion that grabbing the gun and hitting somebody over the head wouldn't be an attempted aggravated assault.
Well, the reason I'm saying that actually is because of the statutes you cited, because 12-4.2 says a person commits aggravated battery with a firearm when he, in committing a battery, knowingly or intentionally, by means of the discharging of a firearm. So it's a particular statute. It's not one that covers pistol whipping or beating somebody over the head. That's probably a battery, too, but it's not the one you were citing.
Right. I believe Judge Mim found reasonably, based on the facts that were before him, that the defendant was not going for the gun to get rid of it. There are other ways to do that, and you wouldn't do that.
What evidence allows us to resolve doubt? There are a lot of times that evidence is just an equipoise, and even on a preponderance standard, you need something, to push you over that 50% mark. What is it that helps us know that he wasn't intending to just hit someone on the head or throw it away?
I believe the whole scene, as the events unfolded, going for the gun or moving towards the waistband, which the court found was going for the gun, at the time he's told to stop and put your hands up,
right,
is a violent act.
Well, and that is an act which, again, I have no personal problem with the concept that his that conduct posed a serious risk of injury to the official victims. Six levels, I understand that. That's a greater punishment because of that kind of risk to potential victims. But on the conduct base, the offense-based adjustment, what allows us to know that he is, in fact, taking a substantial step with a specific intent to fire the gun?
We certainly can't look into the mind of the defendant. We can only look at his actions. And his actions in going for the gun, as the court found at that time, led Judge Mim to the only reasonable conclusion I submit that he could come to.
But it's not a conclusion that fits with all of the other Illinois cases that apply this particular statute. Those are all cases in which people point guns at somebody, they brandish guns at somebody. They're much further down the line toward a reasonable inference that the gun is going to be discharged.
That may be the case. I think the court here, however, was warranted in coming to that conclusion.
Why
based
isn't
on
it
everything.
Pure speculation?
Again,
we're only talking about does he get four more levels or not. This is not a guilt-innocence point. This is a sentencing severity point.
Right, which in the great scheme of things, his sentence, eventual sentence, would have been right in the mid-range had he not gotten that, or within the range, had he not gotten that additional level.
Of course, as you well know, the district court has to start with the right advisory range before
right.
The sentence is announced.
I am aware, yes. And the district court was aware of that as well. But I think that what the district court had in front of him was a man with a history of violence, a man with a history who has been involved in shootings before, a man who had a loaded gun. This was not a loaded weapon in his pocket, and the evidence that the informants had said he is there to do violence tonight. So I think the district court reasonably could conclude by a preponderance of the evidence that was before it that the defendant was reaching for the gun not to throw it away, not to hit somebody with it, but to shoot somebody with it. The evidence is what it is, and the court is right. It is, for the most part, not disputed. It was a fairly violent situation. Would you like me to address the JL question, or?
It's up to you.
Okay.
Unless one of my colleagues would like to ask any other questions.
If there are any other questions, I'll be glad to address them. If not, I'll waive the rest of my time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'll give you a minute, Mr. Tassett.
The four-level adjustment that Judge Wood is referring to is based upon those cases, Purifoy, Brits, and others that are relied upon in the briefs, where the defendant points a firearm at police during the execution of a warrant, or in one case, the defendant thrust a knife through an open window. So clearly, those cases allow the inference of the intent to harm and to commit the intended crime. No such evidence exists in this record for the court to make such a finding that the possession or use of the firearm was done in connection with the attempted commission of another felony offense. It's a stretch by which this record cannot sustain. Secondly, with respect to the 3A, six-level adjustment, again, government is making the same claim that the defendant, through his repeated attempts to retrieve a loaded handgun, was to use that handgun against the officers.
But surely that one, it did pose a risk of injury. The gun was loaded. It could have accidentally even discharged.
Well, but to use against the officers is a critical component of that finding by the court in regards to the substantial risk of harm. Else every confrontation or resistance in this circumstance is going to automatically trigger that six-level adjustment. And there's nothing in this record to support a finding that it was intended for use against the police. For those reasons, we ask that the court send the case back for new further proceedings or to vacate the sentence and remand for resentencing. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.